Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And broadcasting live from New York City, from the Big Apple, from the mothership here at Air America headquarters, Tom Hartman here with you. Last night, this is so ironic. Last night we went to see an advanced screening. Tonight in Hollywood is the premiere of Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour. You can see a trailer up at the top at tomhartman.com if you want to check it out. And it was an extraordinary time and an amazing movie. And afterwards, great reception. I mean, it was just all around a fine thing. But here's this movie about, in part, I mean, it covers just the whole range of environmental disasters and what's being done about them, but in part about global warming and weather and all this kind of stuff. And this morning, New York City got hit by this wild freak storm. I mean, everybody here at Air America is telling stories about how they couldn't get into work and, you know, walking miles and miles because the subways were flooded. And in fact, according to one news report that's been published over at Huffington Post and is from the TV Newser, the New York City headquarters of Fox News is completely flooded. There's a tarp hanging from the newsroom ceiling and vacuums trying to dry up the soaked rugs. Quite a mess. Well, that's entertaining. Yeah. So it's just totally strange. And at the same time, in today's New York Times, warming threatens farms in India. Top United Nations officials warned Tuesday that the vagaries of climate change could destroy vast swaths of farmland in India, ultimately affecting food production and adding to the woes of already desperate peasants who live off the land. They're saying India could lose 125 million tons, 18% of its total annual food production as a consequence of weather changes that are already underway and already measurable in India. So into this breach comes the debate, what do we do about it? Keith Lockich is with us. He's with the Ayn Rand Institute. He has a PhD in physics from the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee and is a resident fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute, the objectivist think tank, the objectivists, the original devotees of Ayn Rand who in many ways inspired the libertarians, who inspired some of the more conservative of the conservatives in the Republican Party. But these guys at Ayn Rand, the original thinkers, AYNRAND.org. Keith, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
So this article, Environmentalists Against Buying Green, this press release that the Ayn Rand Institute put out, give me the elevator speech here, Keith.
Well, basically, environmentalism in the last year has really hit the mainstream in a big way. You know, I think the general public has really bought into it in a way that they haven't in the past. And you would think that people who've been in the environmentalist movement for a long time, you know, really hardcore devotees of the ideology would be happy about that. But what I've found is exactly the opposite is occurring. You hear voices from the environmentalist camp complaining about, you know, what they call eco-narcissism and, you know, green consumerism. They say this is an oxymoron. My view of this is that, you know, there's a basic misunderstanding of what environmentalism is really all about. People think of it as a movement whose goal is sort of to protect the environment for human benefit. But what you find is that whenever there's a conflict between leaving nature untouched versus altering it for some human benefit, people who are really consistent with the fundamental principles of environmentalism always choose to sacrifice human beings for nature. And at a certain point, it becomes apparent, you know, that the goal of the movement really is not to protect nature for man, but from man. And I think that's what explains this criticism of mainstream environmentalism.
Speaking as an environmentalist and as an author on environmental issues, I mean, my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, is even used as a textbook in several universities around the United States. I have to say, the cornerstone of environmentalism in terms of philosophy is that humans are not separate from nature, that we are part of nature, and nature is part of us. And that's the core concept. It's not a matter of, Is it humans better? Is it nature better? Is it one or the other? The core mythos of our culture is that somehow we are separate from and sovereign over nature. And the reality is that we are part of nature, and we can't escape that. We're animals on a planet that's populated by animals and plants, by and large. And you know, we're just another part of nature, and we tinker with that nature at our own peril.
Well, I think the question is, the real question is, do we have a right to reshape nature and alter it for our benefit? You know, do we have
I don't think that's the question. I think that there's a larger question, but it gets to the same one, Keith, and I'd love to get your take on this. We're talking with Keith Lockage from AyonRand.org, and that is, does nature have rights?
Well, that is the fundamental question, and I think, you know, environmentalism as an ideology holds that it does, that nature is an intrinsic value in and of itself, completely apart from any benefit to human beings. And
not apart from, because human beings are part of nature. I mean,
if you're saying to
a corporation, you can go ahead and you can destroy the natural world around us. I mean, we're driving 50,000 species extinct a year. We're polluting the air with all these heavy metals and poisons and things. We're, you know, all the results of burning oil and everything. You say, okay, you can do that. You can totally externalize all your costs. Then who's to speak up for nature?
Well,
if not us who call ourselves environmentalists.
But there's a flip side to
because
that, because when you have environmental regulations that prevent development, you've got a heavy economic burden that people have to pay. Who's going to speak up for man? My question. And here's the point.
How is it an economic burden to prevent yourself from going extinct?
Well, look, the issue is, you know, we're raised the question of is nature intrinsically valuable? Does nature have rights? The point is that you have to, and you're trying to say that there's no conflict here, but the point is situations constantly arise where there is a conflict. There's a conflict between some human value, which requires altering nature, and the alleged intrinsic value of leaving nature alone. Now, I say that a consistent environmentalist will choose, you know, to leave nature untouched, and that requires sacrificing human values. It requires giving up the benefits of human
only rights. Only if you have a very, very limited view of human values. Let me just lay out two real quick points, and the first being that nature is essentially a finite thing. We have planet Earth. There's no more planet Earth, right? So you have this finite biosystem. Our economy is growing within it. And as it grows greater and greater, it consumes more and more of the net productivity of nature. Right now, we're consuming somewhere between 40% and 50% of all the products of photosynthesis on this planet, human beings are. That's mind-boggling. That's up from like 5% just 200 years ago. Almost 50%, number one. And number two, as we do that, as we externalize those costs, as we dump them onto nature and internalize a small number of us, the profits, we are putting at risk not only the planet, not only other species, but ourselves. We're part of this entire system. And those external costs are never considered in the equation of, oh, well, you're going to prevent growth.
Well, the point is those kinds of projections of catastrophe have been around for
decades. This is not a projection. This is an actual real statistic.
The economist Julian Simon liked to point out that the ultimate resource is man's rational mind, our ability. You know, whenever we've faced crises,
and I agree with Julian Simon on that.
Innovation has solved the problem.
Absolutely, Keith. And so let's
predicting. Let's
look at a system.
Environmentalists were predicting a population bomb. You know, there were predictions that England wouldn't exist by the year 2000, but innovation, technology, you know, the kinds of rational progress that we're capable of blows those kinds of the calculations out of the water.
No, Keith, we're singing on the same page. But listen, in nature, first of all, if you have the economy growing without limit in a finite system, that's like cells in your body growing without limit in the finite system of your body. That's called cancer, number one. Number two, in nature, there is no such thing as waste. In biological systems, nothing produces waste. Everything is something else's food. 100%. Everything is something else's food. And yet we have an economy that's based on a system that generates waste that has no value except a destructive value. We're behaving like cancers.
Until some genius comes along and has an idea of how to do something with that waste that's economically viable and, you know, will be another source of energy or a source of...
Why not go to an economy that's not waste-based? Well, we produce 22 tons of waste right now for every ton of consumer goods in the United States.
Well, because, what economic, legitimate economic incentives are there to do that? I'm not talking about
how about a carbon tax?
Huh?
How about a carbon tax?
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. If the way you want to get there is through government regulation, taxes, government subsidies, that is not free market incentives, legitimate incentives to do that.
So you don't think it would work?
I don't think it's right.
Probably a more legitimate point. Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org. Keith Lockich, thanks, Keith, for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call
866-303-2270. There's a price for freedom and a price for truth, and money doesn't bleed red, white, and blue.
Sounds like a good plan. Hey, on this day in history, by the way, this is interesting. Just a very interesting juxtaposition. In 1968, on this day, August 8th, in 1968, Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew received the Republican Party nomination. On this day in 1974, Richard Nixon announced that he was going to resign as president.
On this day in 1974, President Richard Nixon made a dramatic announcement.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
The guy was having a really, really rough second term.
You cut that. I just wanted a little piece of Nixon out of that. Interesting. Yeah. So there we go. Nixon, toast. On this day in history, and a fine thing it was. Also on this day in history, Vice President Agnew in 73 first started fighting back. Well, anyhow, it's interesting stuff. A couple of important points that I think were made, and by the way, my final comment to Keith as we went into the break, that if he's going to take a stand, his taking the stand about what's right rather than what's practical, my point was that that's consistent with the objectivist philosophy, that this is that they're taking an idealistic and philosophical view of things. It's not one with which I agree, but I respect. I think I always respect idealists. However, being an idealist myself in other areas, however, I think it's really critical that we note that the economic system that we call unregulated capitalism, raw capitalism, naked capitalism, laissez-faire capitalism, in an unregulated state, is like cellular division inside the body in an unregulated state. Normally, cells operate in a regulated state, in what's called homeostasis, biological homeostasis. They're limited by the amount of food available to them. They're limited by their own internal control mechanisms. They're limited in the speed and size of their growth. They do grow and reproduce, but within certain boundaries and limits. And they behave cooperatively with all the other cells in the body. Your kidneys don't try to take over your liver. Your liver doesn't try and take over your eyes. Your eyes don't try and take over your feet. You know, on it goes. Right? And when individual components of a finite system rise up and start eating out the core of that system, as I said, that is referred to as cancer. And we have a finite system that is known as the biosphere. It's the world we live in. It is absolutely a finite system. It is not infinite. And yet everybody's talking about economic growth. Oh, we've got to grow the economy. I've got a better way to grow the economy. I've got 16 plans to grow the economy. I'm going to grow the economy. Chinese are growing the economy. In India, the economy is growing. Everybody thinks that's good news. And we're up to the point where we're consuming about half of the total photosynthetic productive capacity of the planet, about half of all products of photosynthesis now. We have taken more than 90% of the large fish species out of the ocean. We've got 50,000 species a year going extinct. Extinction's 99.999% of all animals that have, all species that have ever existed on the planet are extinct. I mean, extinctions are a normal thing. Are we next? And I think that this movie, Leonardo DiCaprio's movie, The 11th Hour, just did a brilliant job of raising these issues and framing these issues and what we can do about them and pointing that out, that it is a finite system, and also pointing out the fact that in nature, and this is, you know, again, the smartest things that we can do, the smartest thing that we can do as a smart species is to imitate nature. You know, you think steel is really strong stuff. You know, spider webs, silk is 5 times stronger than steel, ounce for ounce. 5 times stronger than steel. And it's made at room temperature. And steel requires, you know, incredible heat. It's made with water. I mean, just basic reactions. Spiders eat bugs. They produce something stronger than steel. So let's look at nature. And what nature does is it says everything that is excreted is absorbed by something else. We exhale carbon dioxide. Trees inhale carbon dioxide. They convert it into biomass. And in the process, they exhale a waste product for trees called oxygen, which we inhale. Plants and animals have this perfect dance. Every animal or plant's waste in some way, salmon and bears, for example, you find that for about 100, 150 mile stretch around rivers in the Pacific Northwest, over 70%, as I recall, Stuart Pym told us this in a meeting we had down in San Francisco about 6 months ago, over 70% of the nitrogen in the soil comes from bears eating salmon in the rivers and other large fish, and then walking around in the woods and pooping. And that's what feeds the trees, and that's why there are forests there. At least the mixture of types of trees and the types of habitats that there are. And without those bears or without those salmon, it would be a completely different type of biological system. Why don't we look at nature? Why don't we figure out how to recycle our waste? 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
here we are in New York City. I love this city. It is such a wild and wacky place. There's so much variety. There's everything in New York. For example, night before last, I caught a cab from uptown. I was having dinner with a friend, Ron Hartenbaum, and the cab driver on the way down, I get in the back and I say, I'm going down to 8th and whatever the street was. And he goes, yeah, okay. And he's like leaning over by with his head against the window, he's talking with a fairly thick what sounded like an Indian accent, and he's very much trying to ignore me, and I thought, that's odd, you know. Well, he's got a phone in his ear, and then you take off what? And then I get it after like 3 or 4 lines that this guy's doing a phone sex call while I'm in the back of his cab. It was just the strangest thing. So anyhow, welcome to New York City. we're having a fine old time. Yesterday somebody called, well, actually not somebody called, we had a guest yesterday who said that the iPod was invented in India. And we've had a couple of people correct us on that. One, the more articulate, said the principal designer of the iPod And a tip of the hat to Sue Nethercutt, who passed this along. The principal designer of the iPod as well as the iMac and the iPhone is Jonathan Ive, a British national working for Apple in California. He's currently Senior Vice President of Industrial Design at Apple Inc. There's a great article about him in the November 19th, 2005 issue of The Telegraph, a UK newspaper. So, interesting point. And we're going to get to your calls in just a second. First, though, I wanted to play what I thought was the high point for the debate last night. And not just the high point for the debate, but, I mean, this was even the moment, this was the point that Chris Matthews afterwards turned to Keith Olbermann and said, have we just seen an iconic moment, a moment that's going to transform the political landscape in American history? This fellow comes up to the microphone. He's wearing braces. He's walking with great difficulty. He looks like he's in his early 60s, I'd guess. And he makes his way up to the microphone, and he asks this question, and then they toss it to John Edwards.
After 34 years with LTV Steel, I was forced to retire because of a disability. 2 years later, LTV filed bankruptcy. I lost a third of my pension, and my family lost their health care. Every day of my life, I sit at the kitchen table across from the woman who devoted 36 years of her life to my family, and I can't afford to pay for her health care. What's wrong with America, and what will you do to change it?
Bless you, first of all, for what you've been through. You're a perfect example of exactly what's wrong with America, both on pension protection and on health care. And we've unfortunately not been able to do the things that need to be done in this country. I have a very simple view about this. My view is that we ought to treat the pensions and the retirement of the chairman and CEOs of companies exactly the way we treat every other worker in the country. We ought to have universal health care in this country. We need it in the worst kind of way so that when you're bargaining, you're not bargaining about health care costs. But I want to say one other thing. I intend to be the President of the United States who walks onto the White House lawn and explains to America how important unions and organized labor is to the future and the economic security of this country. It is fine to come up on this stage and give a nice talk. The question is, who's been with you in the crunch? In the last few years, 200 times, I have walked picket lines. I have helped organize thousands of workers with 23 national unions. I have worked with employers. Here's what you need to ask yourself.
Senator, it's great to give a talk.
Let me finish this. It's great to give a talk. It is great to give a talk. But who was with you in crunch time? Because if we were with you in crunch time, we will be with you when crunch time comes for you and all of organized labor. That's the question you need to ask yourself. Who will stand with you when it really matters?
John Edwards hitting one out of the park there. And that's the bottom line. It really is the bottom line, is that if you want to have economic security and you're not a CEO, you want to have a union. And frankly, I would like to see the union movement start getting concerned about environmental issues as well. Actually, many folks in the union movement are. So we're moving in some good directions. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Dale, driving in Ohio. Hey, Dale, what's up?
Hey, thanks so much for taking the call, and thanks for being a good example. Your guest, you don't agree with, but you treated him respectfully. Just want to talk about his arguments a little bit. These guys make a great prideful thing about their logic, but to pretend that our system of quote-unquote unregulated capitalism has never been changed and that any changes we might happen to make would somehow be interfering in it is just so ludicrous on its face. How many changes are made a year in the form of tax breaks and restructuring?
Oh, yeah. In fact, there is no such thing as a free market. There is no such thing as a free economy. The economy is created by literally millions, certainly hundreds of thousands, but I would say probably literally millions of rules and laws that define what can and cannot be done, and courts that enforce those laws, and contract law. And, I mean, you know, if there was a free market, there would be no lawyers if there was such a thing as a free market.
Absolutely. I want to get in one other thought, is that I was always disconcerted for the last 15 years or so when they always published the stock market things as if every time it goes up, it's good, and every time it goes down, it's bad. What about a real life culture index that would measure infant mortality, salmon populations, pollution, and we actually measure something meaningful. So to have Rupert Murdoch in charge of the lead index of how we measure ourselves and broadcast that so much is a bit of a tough thought.
Yeah, I agree with you, Dale, and thanks for raising it. And in fact, that's my concern about Murdoch buying the Wall Street Journal. He's also rolling out a Fox Business Channel. And if you go back to what has been attributed to Mussolini, it was actually one of his advisors who said it, but, you know, fascism should rightly be called corporatism. And you get the idea that what we're looking at here is the corporate takeover of the United States, and that the corporate values are being elevated above human values, so much so that over the last 20 years, we've reached a point now where labor isn't even reported on in our newspapers anymore. I mean, it's not even reported on. You got six guys in a mine who are trapped right now, and nobody's talking about the fact that unionized miners in Canada don't have to worry about this kind of crisis because they have safe rooms they can go to. We don't in the United States because that would cut into corporate profits, you know. And just as one example. And it concerns me that what we're seeing is more and more and more media devoted to business and the interests of business as if that was the economy. And I'm sorry, the economy, mostly the vast majority of the economy, is working people. And there's no discussion of that among the corporate media. And there really needs to be, but there isn't. And so anyhow, we'll see where it goes. Sandra at Berkeley, California. Hey, Sandra.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Just fine. But I'll get better. What's up?
I hope we all do. I was just thinking yesterday, it's almost as if the United States of America was a corporation. I don't know if you ever saw that Danny DeVito movie where he played some ruthless guy who took over corporations that were competition and then gutted them. And that's what I thought. This is kind of like what's happened.
Well, you know, when Bush and Cheney were elected, Bush said that he was going to be the first CEO president of the United States, and he was going to run the company like a company, and he's doing that.
Well, then if we can't impeach them, can we fire them? Because they're doing a horrible job. But it's almost like they've taken the United States and gutted the whole country, taken all the assets, all the money, and put them into other of their corporations. It looks like it's another company.
Right.
It's just very distressing to me. And I don't understand what happened. I just want another side. What happened to the repeal of the War Powers Act? I mean, that seems like all this FISA stuff and everything is based on that. And if we can't repeal that, we can't get rid of these people. I don't understand why we cannot sue George Bush, or we cannot fire him, or we can just tell him that he's so incompetent that, I mean, so anyone can be president. It doesn't matter how incompetent they are. If they run the company into the ground, they bankrupt. I don't understand.
Well, we can fire him. It's called impeachment. It has to be done through our elected representatives. And that means that we have to be leaning particularly on the members of the House of Representatives, because that's where impeachment happens. The trial and conviction happens in the Senate. The removal from office happens in the Senate. That's not going to happen in all probability, but an impeachment is a very real possibility and would send a strong message, not just to this president, but even more important to future presidents, that you can't do this. You can't just eviscerate our Constitution like that. We just will not tolerate it. It ain't going to happen.
Well, what are they waiting for to impeach him?
They're waiting to hear from enough of us that they become convinced that it's not a fringe, loud lefties out there who are demanding impeachment, but that really the people of America want it. And that's why it's important that all of us get out there with all of our friends and contact our elected representatives. Stefan in Phoenix. Hey, Stefan, just a few seconds before we got to take a break here. Quick one.
Tom, I'll move right into it then. It just always amazes me that, hardcore libertarians or objectivists like your last interview want to tout the fantastic abilities of human beings and human mind power to overcome obstacles and to adapt and change. And then when someone comes along and says, hey, you know, can we, you know, maybe change our impact on the environment? They say, you're going to destroy my ability to make money, but you know, what happened to that claim that you can overcome all obstacles?
Oh, that's an interesting point. So essentially they're saying, you know, we can't have change because we've got this system, and yet ingenuity is the most wonderful thing, and ingenuity can create, you're right. There's a logical internal contradiction there. Stephen, Stephen?
Stefan,
thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2273. Yeah, for better or for worse, the future has arrived. 866-303-2270. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, before I get to my main point, I just want to let your earlier caller know there is another index as an alternative to the GDP, and that's the GPI, which is a genuine progress indicator. You can look it up on Wikipedia.
Okay, great. I'll have to do some homework on that myself, Jeff. Thanks for the heads up.
Yeah. As far as the whole thing of waste, the problem is in our system, we don't look at the early stage of things. Designers don't look at the whole effects of what they're designing will do. And if you read something such as Natural Capitalism by Paul Hawk and Amory and Hunter Lovins,
yeah,
you'll see they look at the whole stream, and it makes great business sense. I mean, without any government intervention, to eliminate waste to begin with, if we just use less than half the materials.
Yeah, and in fact, Paul is in Leonardo DiCaprio's movie in several places, and essentially makes that point. And what it's calling for really is a fundamental rethinking of the way that we, as you said, design, the way that we design things, the whole idea of you know, how things work and why they work and why they work that way and how to make them work that way, so that we can generate products that are complete. Not just the product itself is recyclable, but all of the products that go into making the product are recyclable,
yeah,
and the waste materials are recycled, and everything is a closed loop.
Yeah. Most packages we buy in the store are like more than twice the size they need to be.
Sure.
If we designed it to the size it really needed to be, it would take half the space in the store. The store could be half the size, use half the energy for heating the store. The truck could have twice as much product, so we'd use half as many trucks and half as many boats to transport them and so forth.
Yep.
Just by the size of a package.
Yeah.
And that makes more profits.
Yeah, it's a very straightforward process. Well said, Jeff. Thank you very much. Steve in San Luis Obispo. Hey, Steve.
Hello.
You're on the air. What's up?
Hey, how you doing? Just a thought. I have a solution that really does go a long way to solve a lot of these problems that we're talking about, like imports from China and local farmers. I'm a local farmer, and fuel efficiency and domestic economy, all these things. How about a carbon tax?
Yeah.
If we attach a carbon tax for every mile that anything is moved,
yep,
and there you go.
Yeah, and
local
and
producers now
and run it sort of like a value-added tax, where at every stage of manufacturing, at every stage, every time a product is modified or resold, the carbon that went into that modification or resale is added as a tax. So if you're shipping something from China, you're going to pay for the diesel fuel to operate that container on the way over here. If you're driving it from the truck to the port, from the port to the city, you know, and every step along the way, and do away with the income tax.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, you know, to address what the last speaker just said in packaging, I'm a strong proponent of reducing packaging and making it recyclable from the start. But you can do that with this carbon tax as well, by taxing the materials that go into these type of things. And if they are a closed loop recyclable system, then you get credits for that tax.
Yeah. And plus you have products, more products that you can sell, because if your waste product now is actually a valuable product, then you're producing multiple streams of stuff. Well said, Steve. Thank you very much. Lee in Duval, Washington. Hey, Lee.
Hey, Tom. You made a good argument with the Ayn Rand guy, and your last two callers have been just awesome. That four-step, that step book program, I have that too. It's really good. What the guy was missing, the Ayn Rand guy, is that there are a lot of economic benefits to environmentalism, and they really like to portray this as there is, you know, environmentalism is anti-economics, and that's just because I think the people who are in control of the major extraction industries are are themselves maybe going to get shoveled aside a little bit, shuffled aside, and some other people.
Sure, and they've got a lot of money to lobby and to try and change public opinion. And there's this incredible effort out there to portray anybody who would say, hey, wait a minute, not only is there the environment, but it's part of us and we're part of it. It's, you know, we to portray us as Luddites or as crazies or something. And in fact, I think that we're the most rational of the bunch. Lee, well said. Thank you very much. Good to hear from you. Robert in Daly City. Hey, Robert.
Hi, Tom. I saw manufactured landscapes last night, which shows that the United States basically leads the production, the recovery of all these toxic materials at the end of the production line, whereas in Europe, they figure in everything, you know, within the manufacturing process so that they can recover all the valuable components like computers and things like this. And I think people should see that movie, Manufacturing Landscapes.
Okay, I'll check it out. I'm not familiar with it, but it sounds like a good one. Len in New York City. Hey, Len.
Hi, how you doing? You know, whenever I hear corporation now in terms of power, I have to keep reminding myself to remind others that we're really talking at this point about multinational corporations. And we're talking about companies which produce 50 to 80% of their revenues outside of the U.S.
Yeah, like General Electric and like ExxonMobil. I'd say they're not just multinational, because multinational implies a corporation that does business in two or three nations but is still somehow tied to the nation state. I'd say they're transnational or global in as much as they are larger than nation states, and they consider themselves to be operating independent of nation states.
Whichever the important thing here is that at least in the past you might have had a U.S. corporation owning the media and espousing issues that dealt directly with their own U.S. interests.
Right.
Now you're hearing these global corporations own the U.S. media and really are disseminating information with only their own interests.
Right.
Beyond our borders.
No, absolutely. Our CEOs used to live in our communities. They used to have to face the people that they worked with, and they used to have to report on the news that's going on. And now it's the small handful of people who live in gated communities and fly in private jets. Tupac in Phoenix, just a few seconds before we've got to wrap the hour, Tupac.
Good morning, Tom. I just wanted to add to the commentary. In the rethinking process, part of it is the recognition of the anomalies that are out there and how we can build into a sustainable economy in the future.
I'm still listening.
And I would say that one of the elements that we need to redefine is the very concept of currencies themselves.
Yeah.
And get away from just the monetary elements and definitions to the ecological and human definitions of what currencies really are, such
very,
as the air.
Very, very well said. The air, the environment. Tupac, well said. Thank you.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
The environment is a big issue. And there are a few other things in the news that I think are really, really worth talking about. The first has to do with China. We are now in the fifth year of this program, and I've been talking about this literally from day one. In fact, in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, the first edition of which was printed in 1996. That was, what, 11 years ago. There's a chapter about China, about how, and at that time, and that was based on a month that I spent in China in November of 1986, 10 years before that, 20 years ago now, where I lived at the Beijing International Acupuncture Teaching Hospital and studied acupuncture for a month and wandered around Beijing and got to know people and learned very little bit of Chinese and learned a lot about acupuncture, not enough to practice it. It was a great opportunity and a fascinating time. But the point, and at that point in time, in 1986, you could stand on the main street there at the edge of Tiananmen Square. This is main, like, you know, 16-lane avenue or 12-lane, you know, huge thoroughfare in both directions. And maybe every minute or two, and a minute's a long time, maybe every minute or two, one car would go by. Mostly, it was an ocean of black bicycles, just an absolute ocean of bicycles. This was before China. Well, it was. This was the year that Clinton was pushing through NAFTA and GATT. I mean, this was when we were kicking the doors open and saying, okay, we're not going to protect American manufacturers anymore. We're not going to have a trade policy that acts in the benefit of the United States anymore. We're instead going to get lots of cheap stuff for Walmart to make the Walton family billionaires, and we're going to transfer our manufacturing floor to countries where the labor is cheaper so that the big transnational corporations can make more profit. And China, over the next 10, 20 years, it's been 20 years since 86, I wrote about my 1986 experience in my 1996 book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. And even then, in 86, I had been walking, one of the physicians there became a friend of mine, and he and I, we took this long walking trip around Beijing and went through the museums and stuff. And he was talking about how the buzz was, that the 19th century was the European century, the 20th century was the American century, and the 21st century was going to be the Chinese century. And China was going to rule the world by the end of the century. And today's, and I've been, you know, waving that flag ever since, saying, you know, okay, empires come and go. I'm not anti-Chinese. My wife's brother is married to a woman from China. I've spent time in China. This is not about being opposed to a nation or a race or anything, nothing like that. It's about, are we as a nation going to surrender our sovereignty to another nation, our economic destiny to another nation, and ultimately our political destiny, simply so some transnational corporations who don't frankly give a damn about the United States except as a market, simply so they can make more money? Because that's what we've been doing for 20 years. And the point that I've been making is that China is not a democracy. It is a brutal dictatorship. Today's Financial Times, article by Murray Dickey in Beijing. Today is the 1 year, you know, or yesterday, actually, 1 year before the Olympics in Beijing. And they're a big celebration. Okay. Beijing police briefly detained foreign journalists reporting on an event held by press freedom activists yesterday, underscoring the media management challenge Chinese authorities face ahead of the 2008 Olympics. The incident, which occurred within sight of the headquarters of the Beijing Olympics Organizing Committee, will arm critics who argue China has failed to meet its 2001 pledge to give international media, quote, complete freedom to report, end quote. They're not doing this. By the way, keep in mind, the largest satellite TV service in China, Star TV, owned by Rupert Murdoch, and he agreed to let the government censor it. You know, Google and Yahoo go in, and yeah, you can censor our, you know, this is not a democracy. Okay, they'd followed on an unauthorized press conference by members of Reporters Without Borders campaign group, who called for the release of about 100 journalists, online dissidents, and free speech activists who are imprisoned in China. After the event, uniformed and plainclothes police physically prevented foreign journalists from leaving the area, in some cases for more than an hour, according to reporters present. Beijing has tightened controls on domestic media in recent years, clamping down on reporting by internet companies and jailing a number of journalists and commentators. So we have that happening on the political scene. Now is where, so here's, that's the loaded gun. Right, China having this a political culture of it's a dictatorial nation, it's a dictatorship, a communist dictatorship that is becoming highly capitalist, because capitalism has been around for thousands of years and democracy has only been around for a few hundred. Capitalism does not always lead to democracy. In fact, capitalism has a long history of destroying democracy. So now we get to the story in the Telegraph. you know, the major mainstream British newspaper. You can find it over at their website, telegraph.co.uk, by Ambrose Evans Pritchard, posted this morning. The Chinese government has begun a concerted campaign of economic threats against the United States, hinting that it may liquidate its vast holdings of U.S. treasuries if Washington imposes trade sanctions to force a yuan revaluation, their currency, the yuan. Now, see, here's how it works. Because we no longer protect our local industries with tariffs, we no longer say, okay, if there's a dollar's worth of labor in that pair of shoes made in the United States and only 10 cents worth of labor in China, you pay a 90-cent tariff import tax when you bring it into this country. Because we no longer do that. We stopped doing that in the mid-1980s. If China's labor is cheaper, then their stuff comes into the and it's cheaper than the cost of their labor plus the cost of transportation all the way to the United States, then their stuff comes into the United States cheaper than stuff made here in the United States. And thus, factories in the United States get shut down, U.S. jobs go away, and it's replaced by the Chinese. So the Bush administration's solution to this, and the solution of the Chicago School guys, the monetarists, the conservative economics, the economists, their solution, because they don't want to go anywhere near tariffs. That's government regulating and meddling in the marketplace. They don't want to go anywhere near that. So instead, they say the solution is monetary. What we need to do is have China raise the value of their currency. So if their currency is worth more, then importing things from China, Chinese imports will become more expensive. If at some point they're going to reach the point where they're so expensive that American goods will become competitive, and that would be probably a 200 or 300% increase in the value of the yuan. It's gone up 9% in the last couple of years. The Chinese are not raising this. And so, you know, Paulson goes over and says, please, please raise the value of the yuan. And they go, no. And not only that, we're going to threaten you if you keep talking like this. That's what the Chinese are saying. Two officials at leading Communist Party bodies have given interviews in recent days warning, for the first time, explicitly warning, that Beijing may use its $1.3 trillion of foreign reserves as a political weapon to counter pressure from the U.S. Congress. Described as China's nuclear option in the state media. This is how China is referring to this. They're going to drop a nuclear bomb on the United States. What's it going to be? They're going to sell their treasury bills, their U.S. treasury bills. We borrowed over hundreds of billions of dollars, over $1 trillion from them so that we could finance our purchases from them. And they're sitting on that debt. And if they dump that debt, we're going to see something that's going to make the Great Depression look like an absolute picnic. Again, from the article in the Telegraph, described as China's nuclear option in the state media, such action could trigger a dollar crash at a time when the U.S. currency is already breaking down through historic support levels. It could also cause a spike in U.S. bond yields, hammering the U.S. housing market and perhaps tipping the economy into recession. Well, there's a bit of understatement. It is estimated that China holds over $900 billion in a mix of U.S. bonds. Xia Bin, the finance chief of the Development Research Center, he has a cabinet rank. This is a cabinet officer. Kicked off what now appears to be government policy with a comment last week that Beijing's foreign reserves should be used as a bargaining chip in talks with the U.S. It gets worse. I'll tell you more right after this. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
The president kicked democracy out the door and he shipped it off to a foreign shore, giving birth instead to a holy war. I don't know why those Iraqis got baseball collateral damage when you're waging a war.
21 minutes past the hour. So here's a quote from He Fan, an official of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. This is one of the think tanks that the Chinese use, the government uses when they want to make an official statement that's not an official statement, according to the Telegraph. He Fan, an official of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, went even further today, letting it be known that Beijing had the power to set off a dollar collapse if it chose to do so. Now, this is a quote from the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, from this quasi-government official, this guy, He Fan is his name. He says, China has accumulated a large sum of U.S. dollars. Such a big sum of such a considerable portion in U.S. Treasury bonds contributes a great deal to maintaining the position of the dollar as a reserve currency. Russia, Switzerland, and several other countries have reduced their dollar holdings. In other words, he's saying, we could do this to you, but we've got the most. He says, China is unlikely to follow suit as long as the yuan's exchange rate is stable against the dollar. In other words, don't mess with our currency. And he says, the Chinese central bank will be forced to sell dollars once the yuan appreciated dramatically, which might lead to a mass depreciation of the dollar. In other words, if you want us to raise the value of the yuan, which will bring jobs back to the United States, it'll do it in a meat axe approach, by the way, because it'll, right across the board, raise the cost of all imports from China. There may be some things that we actually do want to import from China, things that we don't make here, or we may collectively decide that we shouldn't make here. Or things that, do we really need to have an industry in the United States manufacturing, for example, Chinese porcelain? You know, or Thai carved sandalwood? I mean, obviously these are extreme examples, but there are things that we have a good wine industry in the United States, but we still want to import French wines because it's a unique product. So there are many Chinese products, particularly some foods and things that we may want to import because they're unique products, but everything? And then they note in the Telegraph, these threats play into the presidential electoral campaign of Hillary Clinton. Ironically, I would add, whose husband brought about much of this with NAFTA and GATT, not NAFTA with China, with GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades, leading to the creation of the World Trade Organization and, you know, permanent normal trade status and most favored nation status with China, who has called for restrictive legislation to prevent America from being, this is quoting Hillary Clinton, being held hostage to economic decisions being made in Beijing, Shanghai, or Tokyo. And she points out that 44% of the total U.S. debt is outside the United States, and that makes us vulnerable. She's right. And then they note, kind of semi-ironically in the article, Henry Paulson, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, said any such sanctions, this is if we were to sanction China for not raising their currency, any such sanctions would undermine American authority and could trigger a global cycle of protectionist legislation. And then they add, Mr. Paulson is a China expert from his days at Goldman Sachs. He's opted for a softer form of diplomacy, but appeared to win few concessions from Beijing on an unscheduled trip to China last week aimed at calming the waters. Yeah, he went over there on his hands and knees, begging the Chinese, and they kicked him to the curb. Said, see you later, Charlie. Meanwhile, the New York Times, laying out many of the dimensions of this, and there's a lot of people very, very concerned about this, the fact that the dollar is crashing, that was in that article. At the same time that the dollar right now is falling relative to other currencies in the world, in other words, we as a nation are becoming poorer. That's just a real good summary. When they say the dollar is falling in value, it means that we, all of us, are poorer. We may not seem poorer relative to each other. If the dollar loses 10% of its value, it doesn't immediately mean that tomorrow I have to give you 10% more to do, you know, whatever we're trading. If I'm selling you a can of paint, or if I'm buying, you know, if you're painting my house, you're doing services. It does mean that in our interactions with the rest of the world, we have to pay 10% more. And because our interactions with the rest of the world represent a significant portion of our economy, over time, it's going to mean that we're all going to have to pay 10% more. And that's called inflation. The destruction of the currency. And the New York Times, just a really well-written editorial today from the editorial board. Despite the Federal Reserve's stay the course message yesterday, investors are betting on at least one interest rate cut by January. See, basically, they're saying, you know, the home mortgage market is going in the tank because it's getting harder and harder to borrow money. We need to reduce interest rates to make so that there's more money flowing around. And if we do that, then people will be able to buy homes again. The problem is, if they do that, it's also going to reduce the value of the dollar. And with the dollar already falling, now you're going to what we're setting up is really the disaster of high inflation plus an economic crash. This is not the Great Depression scenario. It's the Weimar Germany scenario.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back. 34 minutes. No, it's the pain that the entire country is feeling. I'm telling you, 26 years of insane conservative economic policies have brought us to this point. There's just no other way to put it. When Ronald Reagan came into office, the United States was the largest creditor in the world. We owned the debt of more countries. More countries owed us money than any other nation on earth, arguably more than any other nation in the history of the world. And Reagan began 26 years of insane anti-government conservative economic policies that have destroyed or are in the process of eviscerating this country, destroying our economy. And now we are the largest debtor nation in the world. An example of how dangerous this can be. In 1956, England was still in debt from trying to rebuild after World War II. And the United States held a lot of their treasury bills. England and France and Israel, without discussing it with Dwight Eisenhower, who was president of the United States at the time, decided that they were going to invade Egypt and grab the Suez Canal. They invaded Egypt, and Eisenhower was so angered by this that he called up his treasury secretary and he said, start dumping those British treasuries right now. Just start dumping them in the open market. And the value of the pound started falling through the floor. The British freaked out. The British Prime Minister calls up Eisenhower, you're destroying our currency, you're gonna throw our country into a depression. And Eisenhower says, then pull out of Egypt. And the British pulled out of Egypt without even telling their allies, the French and the Israelis, totally screwing up the whole war. That's the power that you can have over another country when you own their debt. And the British have now, you know, built up their savings to the point where they're no longer in that kind of a position. But we are, tragically and terribly, in a huge way. And the largest holder of our debt right now, the two largest holders of our debt, are two countries. You wonder, why are we not crossing Saudi Arabia? They're the second largest holder of U.S. debt. Number one, China. And Japan isn't there. Japan might need to be number two. It might be that China is number three. But in any case, those three nations are the largest holders of our U.S. debt. And it is a bomb waiting to go off in our face. Steve in Sussex, Wisconsin. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I agree with part of what you say. And generally, I listen a lot to your show, and I'm 100% in agreement when you talk about taxes and Ronald Reagan, you know, expanding us into huge debt and basically benefiting 0.1% of America. And I also agree that 52% of marketable U.S. Treasury that right now is foreign-owned, 35% of which is foreign government-owned, which is unprecedented.
Right, these sovereign wealth funds.
Yes. But what you're missing, I believe, is there's this, and you admit, this comes from the Financial Times and probably from Wall Street Journal, which doesn't really have our interests at their heart. They represent the financial elite of the world. And when they talk about China and the Chinese government and other governments, I don't think they are completely honest about I think what's happening is they're positioning themselves to the coming recession, and they are trying to make us believe that what's going to happen is, well, China is not devaluing their currency, and that's why we're going to have a recession in the United States. And that's not entirely
That's interesting.
Fair.
They're setting up a straw man.
Because you know what happens is with that debt is that's U.S. dollar debt, and we print that money. And the Treasury is another arm of our government. So basically, the money is created in the Federal Reserve ever since 1973 when Nixon got off the gold standard, right? It's completely out of, and it depends on how much foreign trade is done.
Right, and as of March of last year, we've even stopped publishing M3, the speed at which we're creating currency in thin air.
That's true, but also it's true that you know, the more trade is going on in U.S. dollars, the more money they can print inflation-free, although I think they are printing even more.
But the flip side of that is when trade in U.S. dollars starts to decline, when countries say that they don't want to hold U.S. dollars as their default currency or as their primary currency or use it anymore, when they say that they'd rather pay for oil in euros or dinars rather than dollars.
But can they do that? Realistically, Tom, what would happen to the Chinese economy, to this robust, 8, 10, 15% growth, annual growth, if the U.S. marketplace just falls off the cliff?
I think if the U.S. marketplace fell off the cliff right now for China, that their growth would probably drop in half. But keep in mind, Europe is in the same position we are. It's amazing. You travel around Europe, and everywhere you go, you see Chinese-made consumer goods. The European textile industries are in the toilet. European workers are, you've got, strikes happening. The railroads, I realize it's not related to China right now, but the German railroad system is on the verge of shutting down. But
I completely agree. This is one side of the story that's never been told, that all these foreign traders we're talking about, just in 2004, the U.S. multinational employed 31 million offshore workers and had a reported revenue of $292 billion from offshore activities. And that's registered as trade with China,
Right. And that's money that just 20 years ago would have been in the United States and jobs that would have been in the United States.
Exactly. So I think you're absolutely right on the money when you talk about taxing these people and bringing up the tax, closing the tax loopholes.
Yeah, but your point is that you don't think that China's going to pull the trigger because they'd be shooting themselves in the foot. And I think that broadly speaking, you're right. But what they're doing is they're threatening us now. And I do think that they would pull the trigger over Taiwan, because countries are not just prone to, but there's a long 7,000 year history of what we call Western civilization of countries behaving irrationally.
I would be very careful with that, because I think this nationalism is played against the people, and if you see who is benefiting from Iraq, those will be the same people who will benefit from Taiwan.
Yeah.
I mean, there will be no nuclear show off or a nuclear holocaust between China and the United States, because just simply the two elites are so interlocked.
Well, and not only that, they have the ability to bring us down without firing a single bomb. I mean, it was 2 years ago that the head of their military, the head of their army, said that they had over 100 nuclear weapons pointed at U.S. cities, and they were willing to use them if necessary. That was never retracted, but the fact of the matter is that they don't need to, and that's what this guy is saying today.
Yeah.
Steve, I've got to move along. I appreciate the call. Very thoughtful. Thank you very much. Terry in Greenbelt, Maryland. Hey, Terry, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You're getting better every day.
Oh, thank you.
I wanted to add a slightly different twist on some of the topics that you've been hitting on today. Whether it's the huge problem with multinational corporations or the delicacy of the biosphere and our interdependence, the vast crisis with our healthcare system, our infrastructure crumbling, or the problem with labor and unions being not allowed, and all of these issues, I think, go back to, or there's a dimension of them on another plane, which is somewhat spiritual, and that's the question of what causes happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And we're always talking about gross domestic product here. And there's a small country in the Himalayas called Bhutan. And instead of talking about gross national product, they talk about gross national happiness.
Yeah, and in fact, I've seen the profiles of it. The reality is that once you're at a certain point in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, once your safety and security needs are covered, and frankly, that's not true for most Americans because we don't have national health care in this country, and people are one job loss away from living on the streets. But once your basic core needs for safety and security are met, and then your fundamental simple relationship needs of family and significant other are satisfied. Once those are taken care of, more stuff does not produce more happiness.
Absolutely. And I think a good dialogue for Americans with all of these many problems that go back to how our economic system is affecting the totality of our lives and our happiness, we need to ask ourselves, what kind of country do we want to be? And somehow we need to find a way to pick leaders who will not only have evolution within the physical body, but an evolution of consciousness.
Right. No, absolutely. Well said, Terry. And this takes us back to the question, is the economy here for us or are we here for the economy? And I think it's here for us. JR in Vancouver, I've got to take a break here in a second, JR. What's up?
Okay, I'll be quick. Yesterday you had a guest that was talking about the global marketplace and how it can't be reversed and how it's good for America. Well, she made the case, essentially, without stating it, that America's role as in a global economy is as labor, not even as labor, as
consumers. Right.
And that doesn't help our economy, and it does not help our national security. I have no problem with companies like Apple or Intel hiring foreign labor outside of the United States because it does bolster their economy and it does help others. But we need to build an infrastructure within this country that builds superior products to the rest of the world so they will buy our products. If you look at the filming industry, they don't buy the cheapest product available, they buy the best product available.
Yeah, and over half of the film industry in the United States now, by the way, is foreign-owned, starting with Sony. But, good point, JR, and well said. 45 minutes past the hour, are we just a click away, a mouse click away in China? Click, yes, sell. $1 trillion. Are we just a click away from a disaster?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Get out of this hole. I mean, this is really the we've talked throughout this hour of this economic disaster. The Telegraph reporting that the Chinese are now threatening the United States with dumping dollars to bring about an economic depression in the United States if we don't behave the way they want. Lead editorial in today's New York Times about the weak dollar and the Fed. Bernanke, basically Greenspan painted Bernanke into a corner and then said, see you later, here's the paintbrush. And the New York Times rightly points out the solution, at least half the solution, is to encourage savings at the personal level. Get Americans saving again. How do you do that? You give them incentives to save. Instead of saying your taxes, your maximum tax rate is only 15% if you make your living sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, which is how Bush did it. Instead, say, oh, you want your maximum tax rate to be 15%? Fine. Put some of your money into a savings account. And number two, we need to dump these trade agreements, these absolutely insane trade agreements. Dennis Kucinich is absolutely right on this. John Edwards dances around the edge of it. Everybody else seems to love them. Totally walk away from them. Ross Perot, that crazy old coot with the big ears, he was right. And we need to undo the damage that's been done over the last 26 years with this whole series of insane trade agreements that have put us in this position where China now controls our foreign policy. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com on the line. Hey, Ellen.
You're saying it beautifully, but let me move on.
Okay.
Today the White House put out in their sort of morning briefing the fact that the U.S. strategy has seen success in the Anbar province in Iraq, down to 100 attacks a week from 425 last year. Well, that's all fine and good. Except now we see that, as you know, there were four more troops yesterday and a British soldier who died in the attacks yesterday, but that now U.S. commanders are saying that rogue Shiite militias have stepped into the gap left as the Sunni insurgents have been essentially pushed back. So, yeah, you know, I don't know, I'm sure I'm showing my age, but if you recall those Three Stooges, where, you know, one drawer closes and two open.
Right.
I mean, that's exactly what we're seeing here. Yeah. And how they, you know, they have, as my friend Tony Snow says, the chutzpah to say, well, things are going fine because now we've controlled the Sunnis in the Anbar province, but now we've got a Shiite problem.
Well, the Bushies have set it up so no matter what happens, they win. If the Shia are killing our troops, then they say, oh, it's Iran backing it, because Iran is the, you know, the large Shia country next door. If it's Sunnis killing our troops, they go, oh, it's Al-Qaeda. And so either way, they have a handy villain to blame.
Well, that's for sure. And, of course, they're also talking about how they've been able to push back and that a year ago there was all of this on jihadi websites.
I'm curious, Ellen.
That's the official word.
Yeah, yeah, and the official, yeah. I'm curious about your take on Wesley Clark's op-ed in today's New York Times. Did you read this? Are you familiar with this?
I did not read it, unfortunately.
He points out, just in a thumbnail, he points out the fact that when you're a soldier, you have certain rights that civilians don't have. Primarily, the right to kill other people. That you can, you know, if you're a civilian and you kill other people, you go to jail or you get executed. It's a crime. If you're a soldier and you kill other people under certain circumstances, you get rewarded. And his point is that by identifying Al-Qaeda as combatants rather than as criminals, we have, well, here, I'll quote him. He says, it dignifies criminality by according internet terrorist killers the status of soldiers. Under the law of war, military service members receive several privileges. They are permitted to kill the enemy, and they are immune from prosecution for doing so. He goes on to point out that, in fact, if we're saying that Al-Qaeda are soldiers, then their attack on the USS Cole and their attack on the Pentagon were legal under the rules of war because soldiers can attack the enemy.
Okay,
it's
yeah.
Amazing. And he says, we should deal with these guys as criminals, not as soldiers. And the Bush administration is going about it all backwards, and they're totally not destroying our credibility all around the world and making it legally impossible for us to do anything about these guys.
Well, and putting them in Guantanamo and then causing us more international
right.
distress. And actually, as you know, Britain wants their Gitmo prisoners back.
Right, right.
One other interesting thing today, Mitch McConnell decided to write his own op-ed, and he did it in his local newspaper in Louisville, and he is now saying that this S-chip, which of course we've been hearing rumblings of the Republicans saying that, that it's luring people away from the private market that will eventually remove 2 million people from the private health care market.
Right, this is the state children's health insurance program.
That's right, and he said some in Congress hope that this will eventually lead to complete government takeover of healthcare. Give me a break.
Well, some do.
I understand, but that is not what S-CHIP is about.
No, it's not. It's not. But these guys, they don't want one more person to be insured by the government, and they don't want one more person to be drawing Social Security because they think that it's all creeping socialism, and they're just hysterical about it. If somebody can't make a dollar off people getting services, then people shouldn't get services. That's the Mitch McConnell worldview.
I think that's absolutely, and it's interesting that he published it in his local paper, but did not do it in a national paper.
Oh, that's interesting.
I mean, because I don't...
He's not up for re-election this year, is he?
I don't think he's up for re-election, but as you know, I mean, he has a lot of punch in Congress, and I mean, he is the Senate Republican leader, and so he's using this sort of local paper, hoping, you know, that it gets, that it can get his troops all revved up in Kentucky, but perhaps doesn't get the national attention.
Yeah. Well, I think this is the main talking point on the right now about SCHIP and frankly, anything else. I mean,
well, they were calling it Hillary health at their radio row last week.
Yeah. And it's not, obviously. It's not even close. But this is where they're going to go. They're going to pull the socialism card. And frankly, I think that a lot of Americans are looking at countries like Sweden and Norway and Denmark and Germany and England and saying, okay, if those countries have socialist governments, socialism isn't all that bad.
That is for sure, particularly since they pay for your education in those countries.
That's right. Free college education in all of them. Thank you very much. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Great talking with you, Ellen.
Thank you.
57 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, sometimes you know what you know. Sometimes you don't know what you don't know. Sometimes what you know, you don't know. And sometimes you don't know what you need to know. And sometimes even everything you know is wrong.
Know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
1 in 50 people are not born a specific sex. 1/3 of the world's economy is based on biotech. Dr. Moira Gunn is with us. Public Radio's Dr. Moira Gunn. Her website, technation.com. And Moira Gunn, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, Tom.
And also the author of a new book, Welcome to Biotech Nation. And why the trademark, the registered trademark after Biotech Nation?
Well, actually, Biotech Nation is a regular segment of Tech Nation, which also has its trademark, and that's the name of our show on that you hear on the National Public Radio channels and Sirius and all over the place, all over the world. We're all over the world, like you are. Tom Hartman is all over the world. And it just happens to be the name. And I couldn't believe it, actually. We proved the whole thing, and then we showed up, and I saw this thing. It's like, there's registered trademarks all over the place. They put it through the lawyer filter after you do the art. Like, okay, I guess. Can you imagine what the Mona Lisa would look like if that had happened?
Well, essentially, that's what Dan Quayle and George Bush Sr. did by granting regulatory authority to the federal government for genetically modified products before they existed. When Monsanto went to George Bush Sr. and said, "Would you create this category?" You know, they didn't even have a product to take to market, which essentially legalized it. Right? I mean, this is.
I think you said a couple of things, that one of which was really nice, that they granted, that the Bush administration granted the right to do the genetically modified foods. I'm not sure exactly how many people and who came and what organizations came to the first president Bush, but he issued several rules for biotechnology, among it, you know, to help the industry, because the administrations are always trying to develop the economic side, and one of them is that we will put genetically modified foods into the environment, into this food supply, as long as they're without undue regulation, as long as they're safe. And so then Dan Quayle came along as vice president, and he was head of the Council on Economic Competitiveness, and he goes, well, you know, gee, it's like most people say, well, science will tell if it's safe. But no, he said, I have a better idea. We'll say they're safe unless science tells them they're unsafe, sort of innocent until proven guilty.
Right.
But only lawyers would do that. Works really well if there's no science at all, I'd like to point out. And so then just months after we have this big food labeling act, Act, which took literally an act of Congress, it included nothing about genetically modified foods because they didn't exist. They were illegal to grow, much less to put in the food supply. So by this sort of ships passing in the night, at the same time we're clamping down so even a jelly bean has to have a food label bigger than it is on it. We have genetically modified foods everywhere, and you can't find it anywhere on the food label.
Right, and so, they represent a huge portion of what we're eating every day.
Exactly. Every other ear of corn is genetically modified in the U.S. 85% of all the soybeans that we grow are genetically modified. And if you don't eat soybeans, I think he's doing one. You don't eat ice cream, you don't eat bread, every packaged food. I mean, the European joke is, you know, what do you call an American supermarket without genetically modified foods? And, you know, the answer is empty, you know.
Yeah.
So, it's like, and who knew? That was 1997. 10 years is that.
Right.
And yet none of this stuff
is on the shelves in England. None of this stuff is on the shelves in Germany.
That's right. None of it is there.
It's illegal.
Go to the European Union. They don't want any part of it. They do have some that they're now feeding. They just got it squeaked in when there was that's a story in itself. Yeah. But they're feeding some of that.
Corn for cattle feed.
To cattle,
yeah.
You know, but that is completely, yeah. You go to Japan, you go to Asia, you'll get both, but they're labeled.
Yeah.
And they're like, what's the big deal? Make a choice. I've got to tell you, Tom, this is not in the book, but I went to the International Bio Conference in May, and they always warm us up with a big media conference, big media lunch. I'm sure you've been to your share. And this time they went through all the data about how's the American public receiving all of the biotech, and that's both the medicine and the bioethanol and all this stuff. But they said, you know, we've talked to 500 men and 500 women, but in fact, you know, we're making headway. There's an 85% acceptance now of genetically modified foods. And then a few minutes go by and they say, but you know, 93% of the food in the United States is bought and prepared by women. And I said, well, how would this go if we asked the same 1,000 people, 500 men and women? It's like, what do you think of that rules change in the upcoming Super Bowl? I think the women would say, fine with me.
Well, right.
So that's like, we're looking at this, you know, in kind of a, they're saying they're making it a women's issue. It's like, well, if we're buying all the food, if you look in the last 10 years, that's when we've seen the growth of organic foods in supermarkets get bigger and bigger and bigger. Women want, they're not just feeding people, they're trying to take care of their families.
Right, yeah,
and
a little
they
sample
want to
bias
give us something.
Study.
Yeah.
We're talking with Dr. Moira Gunn. She's the author of a new book, Welcome to Biotech Nation, My Unexpected Odyssey into the Land of Small Molecules, Lean Genes, and Big Ideas. I'm curious if in the book or in the research for the book you came across the odd story of, as I recall, Klebsiella planticola, the bacteria.
Oh, my goodness, another bacteria. There are so many. I have not come across that. I don't believe
it. Just very quickly tell you, there was a company, this is in the early days of biotech, and there was a company in, as I recall, Utah, that had genetically modified Klebsiella, which is a bacteria that lives on the roots of most plants. It's ubiquitous. And in fact, it might even be a fungus. But in any case, they genetically modified it to produce alcohol. And what they were going to do was have it be the way to convert cellulose into ethanol, and it was going to solve the world's problems, except for the fact that this is one of those bacteria, sort of like E. coli in our colons. It is attached to the roots of more than 90% of all plant species on Earth, and they were going to test it in the wild, and a professor, as I recall, at the University of Washington, this was, as I said, this was more than a decade ago. I wrote about it in one of my books. One of her PhD students said, let's test this stuff and find out what happens. They inoculated plants with it, you know, got the new genetically modified version and discovered that it killed them by converting the cellulose in their roots into alcohol, and the plants died of ethanol poisoning. And had that modified organism gotten out in the wild and had it established itself, it could have ended all plant life on Earth, or at least 90% of it, which would have ended
caught up with it. Exactly. Exactly.
Which would have ended us. And, I mean, there's some very real dangers associated with this stuff.
Well, you know, that's just it. I mean, whatever you do anything, you just can't be cavalier about it. It's like, I'm not saying that the genetically modified food is all unsafe. That's different from being unsafe. It's different from being untested. And when you test it, the first thing you do is for safety. You look for what can happen. You go very slowly because we can't mess around with people's lives. We can't mess around with Mother Nature. Nature.
Yeah. Speaking of Mother Nature, is it really true that 1 in 50 people are born without having a specific gender?
Well, I'd say it a different way, Tom. We used to say, you know, hey, XX or XY, you know,
right.
What are you, girl or boy?
Right.
As it turns out, we can sit down now and see that 1 out of 50, actually it's a little more than that, it's 2.5% of the people are born. They're not exactly XX and they're not exactly XY. Now, some of those people, a whole set of those people, have what you would say compromised or different genitals, and you got to, you know, they used to make a decision within a couple of days of birth, and that was pretty cruel, actually, because half the time they guess wrong. The rest of it, maybe they have a whole lot more, you know, you'll see females with a lot of body hair, a lot of male structure, and you're saying, what's going on? Two, you look exactly like one gender, but inside you've got a brain and an endocrine system or an orientation toward as if you were the other. And when you sit down and you can see it in the genes, when we can look at it in the genes, we begin to look at it and go, oh, wait a minute, you know, maybe this isn't just, you know, you can decide what you are. It's like if you look at plants.
So you're suggesting, are you suggesting that gender confusion, gender identity, or for that matter, I mean, just to say it, to be being gay, for example, is now demonstrably genetic, at least in a subset of the population?
Exactly. That if there's certainly full on undeniable evidence that you have a gender confusion or a gender
difference.
You are intersexed,
yeah. Right.
Is the word.
And I'm assuming this is true. I'm assuming this is true right across the mammal, you know, the animal kingdom.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's true. I mean, it's just like nature. It's like if you've ever grown a plant, you'll notice that all the leaves aren't the same. And a few come out a little this way and a little that way. It's just the way nature is.
Yeah. Diversity is a wonderful thing, actually. We should be celebrating it. Dr. Moira Gunn, thanks so much for being with us. Your new book, Welcome to Biotech Nation, My Unexpected Odyssey into the Land of Small Molecules, Lean Genes, and Big Ideas. You can check it out at technation.com. Dr. Gunn, thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Anytime. Bye-bye.
16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. You know, sometimes things are just a little strange. We have our crazy alert for the day here, and this is absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. I think so. Tori the Escort, as in the hooker, is advertising that she's now available in the Green Zone in Baghdad. If you are a contractor, contractors only, not the military, contractors only, the graciousness of the Private Security Company Association of Iraq, Tori from Atlanta, will be working out of the secured compound in the Green Zone, quote, entertaining all members of the PMC community registered with PSCAI with a few stipulations, end quote. Ah, very interesting. The contractors in Iraq now have their own hooker in residence. Larry Scott is with us with VA Watch. I don't have a segue for this, Larry.
Neither, because I do not have a hooker in residence, Tom.
Good on you. With VAWatchdog.org, the preeminent veterans group in the United States, and you know, thank God our military hasn't gone down that road. I mean, the last military I think that did that was the Japanese in China during World War II. But anyhow, the Veterans Administration, most stress cases missed.
Rather interesting study that, and this just came out. This is in the Army, and we think it kind of goes across the board. And that is, as of right now, the United States Army reports that only 3% of soldiers who have served in combat in Iraq or Afghanistan since 2003 have been diagnosed with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right.
What we're seeing is we're seeing a lot of troops who come back who have a lot of stress problems. When they are initially evaluated, they report stress problems, and some as high as we've seen figures into the 30%, 40% range. What we're finding is as these troops come home, they get missed. They get missed by the system. They get off the boat, if you will, or the plane. They want to go home to their family. They don't go through the mandatory screenings. They do not report it. And so we're finding two things. One, underreporting, and two, underdiagnosed, severely underdiagnosed by the Army. Both of these situations present real problems, Tom.
Right. The military. Well, isn't there also a problem that sort of comes out of the military culture, which is that if you say that you have a psychiatric condition, you're not only are you sort of admitting that you're not a real man's man, but also you are shunned by your peers.
That can be. Yes, there's a great stigma attached. And also there is a great problem with advancement and also security clearances if you have any type of mental health issues. The Pentagon is currently considering doing away with what they call the mental health question when it comes to security clearances or higher level security clearances. They haven't made a decision on that yet, but we find a lot of troops will not self-report simply because they're afraid of their career and they're also afraid of losing a promotion or losing a security clearance. That is the initial problem.
It seems like there needs to be a way to differentiate things like schizophrenia or paranoia, clinical paranoia, from things like post-traumatic stress disorder. PTSD is really an injury. Schizophrenia is arguably genetic. There's still a debate, but it's a debilitating mental illness.
Well, that's what the military is currently discussing. Can we differentiate one from the other and therefore clear these people and try to help them and say there is no stigma attached to this, even though there is at this current time, and move them on up through their military career? That hasn't happened. Quite frankly, I don't think it's going to happen. A lot of the old liners in the military system feel a mental health issue is a mental health issue, and you shouldn't be there if you have one.
Right. What are the other top stories over at VAWatchdog.org right now?
Well, the interesting one is we're going to have a new VA secretary here pretty quickly. Jim Nicholson put in his resignation. He'll be leaving no later than October 1st. And the rumor running around the Hill is we could have a recess appointment for VA secretary.
Oh, no.
This would do an end run on the confirmation process because, as you know, Tom, if a recess appointment is made, that person does not have to go through the confirmation process until the end of the next session of Congress. Well, the next session of Congress ends at the end of 2008. So if President Bush appoints a VA secretary during the August recess, that person would literally serve till the end of the Bush term and would not have to go through a confirmation process. There are a number of reasons they're considering this, and mainly it's because whoever they nominate or appoint would go through an incredible grilling process by the Senate. And I can think of three senators right offhand who would make this a very difficult situation. That's Patty Murray of Washington, Barack Obama of Illinois, and your good friend Bernie Sanders of Vermont. They're going to want answers from any new VA secretary.
Yeah.
Will you take care of these problems? Will you fix it? Will you not be an obstructionist? And they would not make confirmation an easy process like we've seen in the past. Any new VA secretary would have to have the right answers before they were confirmed, so you could see a recess appointment here.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. I'm expecting a bunch of judicial ones, too. These guys, there's just no morality in the Bush administration. There's none. Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, the website for all things relating to veterans issues. If you are a veteran, if you know a veteran, get them over to VAWatchdog.org. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
it looks like I might finally figure out who is that guy following me around when I was here for the RNC convention. Those of you who are longtime listeners will recall that we did this show live in 2004 from here in New York City during the Republican National Convention, the RNC convention. And there were 2 days when I was totally weirded out. You can tell when somebody's following you around. It's like, what's the deal here? Well, a judge here in New York has now said the infiltration by the CIA, or excuse me, by a police spy unit headed by a former official of the CIA. CIA can't do domestic spying. This is the New York City Police. The infiltration of groups like church groups, environmental groups, and billionaires for Bush, the people who, you know, from time to time we play their pastiches, their theme, their stuff has bumpers on the show, was wrong. And that the documents have to be released. In fact, the New York Times in their editorial today, they say the overarching police strategy that culminated in the arrests 3 years ago this month did not feel like it was done with just safety in mind. Because they point out over 2,000 people were arrested during the 2004 Republican National Convention, most of them held until after the convention. What it did was it made it look like there was no dissent. It made it look like everybody agreed with King George. The New York Times notes that such a police action happened in New York and during the large Democratic, small d Democratic show of a political nominating convention was troubling. And they add that along with Mayor Michael Bloomberg's denial of permits for protests on Central Park's Great Lawn, the police action helped to all but eliminate dissent from New York City during the Republican delegates' visit. If that was the goal, then mission accomplished and civil rights denied. Speaking of civil rights and voting rights, I just wanted to give you a heads up. The New Yorker, back in their August 6th issue, Hendrik Hertzberg, writing Vote Scam, this commentary, talking about this piece of legislation or a ballot initiative that they're trying to slip through in California that will cause California to no longer be a state where the majority of the voters in the state determine who all the electoral votes go for. But instead, each congressional district will decide on their own electoral vote. So instead of California going all Democratic or all Republican, and historically it's going all Democratic, instead of California going all Democratic, you might have, you know, some parts of Los Angeles going Democratic and parts of Orange County going Republican, for example. You might have, you know, and so on. And the result of that is that this is pretty much the only strategy left now by which a Republican might become elected president in 2008. Minja Cha, writing over at progressivestates.org, calls it a right-wing ballot scheme to manipulate presidential votes in California. It's being sold to Californians as, hey, it's more democratic. Gets down to the more local level. Plus, the candidates will have to campaign here now. But in fact, the gerrymandering is so thorough and so complete these days, you pretty much know how each district is going to vote in advance. I mean, that's the whole thing. And so Republican gerrymandering first, and now let's split up the California electoral vote. And maybe the Republicans could even pull off a presidential win in 2008 as a result of it. By the way, I got an email. So this is just a heads up to folks in California. Look out for this thing. And, you know, when it gets on the ballot, we'll be talking about it a lot because it needs that's a ballot initiative that needs to go down in flames fast. I got a note from a listener. He says, after my riff about China, he says, OK, so what's left? What do we do? Cheney, Bush, the neocons have just about finished us off. Democrats are complicit in selling us down the river. Our Constitution is disappearing slowly. The once great American middle class is nearly non-existent. New Orleans, our infrastructure, our manufacturing economy moving to the other side of the planet. Our elected representatives ignore us. My doctor says in the last few years his office has seen a marked increase in the number of prescriptions written for antidepressants and insomnia medications. And you scared the hell out of us this morning describing how China can complete the job in a few hours. As you just asked, are we a click away from disaster? You back the hearse right up to the door, Tom. What's left? Where's the hope? It's the old joke, and it isn't funny anymore. What's the difference between our country and the Titanic? The Titanic had a band on board. He says, it's hard to listen to all of you now. You're doing play-by-play on a game that isn't winnable. Signed, Lawrence. Well, Lawrence, let me tell you, it is winnable. England was as badly in debt as we were in 1956, largely, you know, the lend-lease program and rebuilding from the war, and they dug out of the hole. They simply said, we're going to protect our economy. It's not like, and our Constitution has, frankly, in my opinion, been violated far worse than it is right now by previous administrations, in particular the John Adams administration, the second president of the United States, with the Alien Sedition Acts. And not to mention Woodrow Wilson, who was a Democrat during World War I, doing the same thing with another Alien and Sedition Act. So we've been here before. We saw the Joe McCarthy era. I mean, we've seen the terrors of the Reich in the United States. And we've gone through hard economic times. We went through the Great Depression. We went through the Panic of 1896. We went through the Great Panic of 1856, I forget the year, the one that led up to the Civil War. I mean, we've been through difficult times. We went over 100 years in the United States from the mid-1800s to the midnight to the late 1930s, essentially without even having a middle class outside of small family farms. We've seen hard times in this country, and we have pulled through. And Franklin Roosevelt and John Maynard Keynes and others have showed us that it is possible to build a great nation and build a great economy and have a strong middle class and be a pillar, a beacon of light and freedom for the world. It just requires enough of us to be vocal enough in our own particular ways to get enough of our elected officials to say, oh, that's the way we should be going. Oh, look at this. When I talk like Franklin Roosevelt did, or even the Republican Teddy Roosevelt did, I get rewarded by my voters. Gee, I think I'll do more of that. I mean, it's just pretty straightforward stuff. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Mark in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. Thanks for your passion. Canada won its first NAFTA decision on April 24th in the UPS case. Are you familiar with that?
You're talking about a recent one? I'm familiar with the ones that had to do with tetraethyl lead, as I recall, or MBTE, and the one that had to do with the coffin industry, the funeral industry.
Yeah, so this is a seven-year case, and the UPS was suing Canada Post for $250 million, trying to undermine their public infrastructure.
Right.
I put this on Portland Indie Media, and I also sent you an email, and people can click on and read the whole 151-page decision.
So this is brand new. This just happened?
Yes, just April 24th.
So just happened this year?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I found it on the Council of Canadians website.
Yeah, this is the NAFTA Chapter 11 is what it's called. And Chapter 11 has nothing to do with bankruptcy. It's the court, essentially, within NAFTA that is created that has sitting on it as judges, not just representatives of sovereign governments, but representatives of corporations. And
yeah.
under Chapter 11 provisions, corporations can sue governments as if they were a government.
Yeah.
And governments, when they lose, have to pay the corporations. And the corporations can sue not just for lost business or the loss of assets. They can sue for lost opportunity, for lost for potential profits that they might have made. And they have sued like this, and they have won.
Yes, and the Canada's victory could be a hope for all people. Had UPS won, of course, all public services would have been open to corporate takeovers.
Right. So Canada won in this. I'm sorry, I misunderstood you, Mike or Mark. Canada won against UPS in this case?
Yes, yes. It's a three-member court.
Right.
And it was held in D.C.
Right.
Of course, you know, criticizing NAFTA or criticizing Homeland Security is not popular, and so. You know, critical alternative thinking is always marginalized.
Right.
I mean, to me, laissez-faire capitalism is a 19th century philosophy promoted by the Chicago Boys.
Well, it's really a 17th century philosophy. I mean, it's one of the things that we pushed back against. Laissez-faire capitalism is what built up the British East India Company and the British Empire,
now,
and what we rejected basically in 1776.
Neoliberalism could be thought of as the confusion of the goat and the gardener, or trying to bridle the horse by the tail.
Yeah, yeah. Well said, Mark. Thank you very much. Thanks for the heads up on that. I will have to do a little poking around on that. Greg in Burbank, California. Hey, Greg, you want to disagree with me on our currency?
Oh, well, yeah. But before I do that, I wanted to agree with you on socialized
mm-hmm.
ideas, because the alternative is the anti-social privatization we've been living with all this time. Look
yeah.
where it's gotten us.
So why should we devalue our currency?
Oh, why should we? Well, you know, it doesn't bother me if it does become devalued, because
if jeans made
in China become more expensive, then the jeans makers here will open their doors again and make jobs.
No, I agree with that, but oil will become twice as expensive, which arguably may be a good thing, but, you know, it's going to hurt a lot of people over the short term. Any kind of imported foods are going to become more important. Because we have created such an interdependent relationship with the rest of the world, if our currency crashes, it's going to impoverish us worse than we already are. So it's
that is if too much of our value is put on dollar currency.
Yeah. Well,
okay.
the fact of the matter is our currency
dollars,
is
dollars, human values, and the responsible social values.
No. Good point, and I got it, and I agree with you, Greg. And we are devaluing our currency. As I recall, we've lost over 20% of the value of our currency since Bush became president. 46 minutes past the hour, relative to the euro.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
I miss Monica. GW is just logic. It's kind of hard to follow. It's almost pathological, and all its promises sound hollow. And the lies he tells would be hard to swallow, even for Monica, dear sweet Monica, with a cute beret and a pouting lip. She made the most of her internship and learned back then loose lips sink ships. And the scariest thing in the news was a picture of Linda Tripp. I miss Monica.
Yeah, we all miss Monica.
Monica.
You know, one of the actually, I think, good actors in the whole thing. It's just, you know, a fundamentally probably reasonably decent person caught up in a Republican maniacal crusade. I mean, it's just incredible. Sharon in Camino Island, Washington. Hey, Sharon.
Oh, hi, Tom. I love you. I go to class every morning. Nobody can call me from 9 till 12 listening to you.
Oh,
anyway,
thank you.
I think we should frame the free trade, fair trade thing in a soundbite saying an answer to those who say, oh, fair trade is protectionism. We should say free trade is un-American. Plain and simple, America was founded on the principles of fair trade and tariffs to keep the playing field level.
Yeah, and in fact, the American Revolution started in the winter of 1773, and this was the turning point for Jefferson. It was when he stopped talking about how to be a good subject of the British Empire and started talking about independence. Started with the Boston Tea Party, when we said to the world's largest multinational corporation, no. And we threw the tea in the harbor, over $1 million worth in today's value, a $1 million act of vandalism, as a consequence of the British East India Company getting a tax break from the British government that would have made their tea cheaper so that they could wipe out all the small local independent businesses in the United States, or what was the colonies at the time. And, you know, it's just people don't even know the history of the Boston Tea Party. They think it was people were protesting a tax increase. It was a tax cut that they were protesting. You're absolutely right, Sharon. Very well said.
So always answer, free trade is un-American. Don't let them beat us over the head with that Thomas Friedman crap.
There you go.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon. Brilliant. Ed in Arlington, Washington. Hey, Ed.
Hi, Tom. Earlier in the program, your first hour, you were talking about environmentalism, and you used the very apt example of the cells of the body working synergistically along with all the others in order to form a perfect balanced whole. And then when one of those start to go out of control, it's called cancer, and it overblows. I think that is more apt an analogy than you might realize, because when you look at the history of the Western societies in particular, the very basis of the environmental motion or movement began thousands of years ago with the concept of a religious type philosophy that we're all in this together, we're all part of nature, and it was called Gaia. And Gaia was not just the earth, but all the inhabitants therein.
Yeah, it wasn't just thousands of years ago. Every Aboriginal and Indigenous society, or virtually every Aboriginal and Indigenous society, has that as a core notion.
I agree.
And it's, you know, Daniel Quinn writes eloquently about this in his books, Ishmael and My Ishmael.
Right.
And Rhianne Eisler writes about it. And there's a lot of curiosity about why this, you know, Len Schlein's book, The Alphabet Versus the Goddess. How did our brains change that we disconnected from nature?
That's what I wanted to address.
Yeah. So
okay.
why do you think it was?
I believe it was because of the formation of the monotheistic Roman Church, who systematically set out to destroy all philosophies, all other ideas that were opposed to the central authority figure of the Pope and or God.
Well, it wasn't the Catholics who started that. I mean, go back and read the book of Jeremiah. You know, God told him to go into the city of Ai and kill every living occupant and cut the bellies of the pregnant women because of how they believed.
Oh, I agree. But Constantine and future emperors there, and eventually popes, just picked up the process, and it called the Inquisition.
Monotheism has been around a long time. I really struggle with this one, because I don't think that it's monotheism per se, because what's interesting is when you look, and this is the argument Len Schlein makes in The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, and he makes it very eloquently.
Right.
In fact, we should probably get him on the program one of these days to talk about it. I had lunch with him a couple of years ago, but that was, I think, the last time I talked to him. He points out that in Europe, there was a period of time for several hundred years when there was very little violence and there was goddess worship. And the goddess who was being worshipped was Mary. And it was during a time when it was illegal to know how to read or write. Only the priests could read or write. And within one generation of the time that widespread literacy was introduced into Europe, which was in the 1500s after the plague, within one generation, over 1 million women had been put to death as witches. Suddenly, the worship of the goddess was gone, and it was all testosterone all day. And he suggests that learning an alphabet, because that's the abstract, it's abstract, and so you have to, you know, use the left side of the brain for that, at a young age, caused our brains to become out of balance, and therefore our culture's out of balance.
Right, and that's exactly where I was going with this. And we were forced into a patriarchal society that totally demonized the matriarchal society.
Yeah.
And was adopted to usurp cooperation.
Yeah, absolutely. And Rhianne Eisler writes about it brilliantly in a whole series of her books. Ed, thank you for a little discursion there, but a useful and interesting one. And great conversation. Coming up tomorrow, where to go here? I'll be debating conservative Phil Kirpin. Should we increase capital gains tax? Of course we should. Andy Corwin is here on the Who is General Smedley D. Butler, and why should you know and care? This is startling stuff, and the best of the rest of the news and your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.